WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Dave Davies. On today's Fresh Air, treating patients during times of war. We'll talk to Dr. Sherry Fink. She's back from a medical aid mission to Iraq. She also has a new book, War Hospital, about the doctors who treated thousands of patients in Srebrenica during the Bosnian Civil War. The young staff struggled to cope with ghastly injuries, often without training, equipment, or even electricity. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel, Breaking Her Fall. Linguist Jeff Nunber considers the Fox News lawsuit against humorist Al Franken over his use of the term fair and balanced. And we meet pro tennis tour trainer Doug Spreen. He's often courtside at big matches, treating some of the game's top players under intense pressure. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in this week for Terry Gross. Most of us at some point in our lives get hurt, and we have to visit an emergency room. There, we take it for granted doctors will have the training and the tools to deal with our problems, and if they don't, a specialist will. But what happens when a doctor is confronted with a dozen life-threatening injuries without specialized training, x-ray equipment, antibiotics, or even electric lights? Those are some of the challenges faced by physicians in War Hospital, a new book by Dr. Sherry Fink about the struggles of medical personnel in the city of Srebrenica in the Bosnian Civil War. Besides the medical challenges, physicians frequently had to make life-or-death calls about who to treat and how to stay neutral in a venomous and bloody conflict. Sherry Fink has worked on humanitarian and relief efforts with several international organizations in Africa, the Middle East, the Balkans, and most recently, Iraq. She says the health situation there was already bad before the war, but post-war chaos and looting exacerbated the problem.
I still can't quite understand how people can go in and strip a hospital of its beds, put patients on the floor, take just everything out of a hospital or a healthcare center that is supposed to serve the population. It's a little bit of a mystery to me still. But when we came into Iraq, we found hospitals that were just stripped of everything, and not even just the medical supplies, which might have brought the people who took those supplies some money, but also the lighting fixtures, everything. So it's not entirely clear to me what the reasons for this were. It could be that people who were looking for a source of money looted these facilities in order to make some money to sell things on the black market. Or it could be that the population was reacting to the health clinics as they were many other symbols of the government. And indeed, it's been coming out now in part through the research of groups like Physicians for Human Rights that some doctors were complicit in orders that were sent down by Saddam Hussein, orders to mutilate army deserters, for example. It sounds almost unbelievable, but there's evidence that this was the case.
What kind of mutilation? For what purpose?
Well, the example that's been given so far was that all surgeons were required, if asked, to cut off the ears of army deserters, and they were threatened to do this under penalty of their own ears being cut off. I did not speak to many doctors about this, but there was a case where a street had been named after a doctor who actually refused to participate in a mutilation, had stood up to the authorities.
What was the reaction of Iraqi civilians? I mean, you're coming in as Westerners, independent of the military operation that had preceded you, and yet you are Westerners, and I'm just curious what Iraqis, how you were regarded by the Iraqi population.
I found that the Iraqis reacted to me in a wide range of ways. There wasn't one way to characterize it. Different individuals reacted differently, and I didn't quite know what the reasons were for that, why some people were quite cool toward me and toward my organization, others were very welcoming, and it's one of the reasons for that coolness that I found on the part of quite a number of health authorities became apparent to me in the days before I left. And that was that one of the health authorities who had worked very closely with my aid organization, other aid organizations, and the civil affairs teams of the U.S. military had his house bombed. This was the director of health in one of the governorates where I worked. And that just That really drove home to me the fact that these Iraqis, who in many cases were democratically elected by their peers after the war to take positions in the health system, were putting themselves at risk by working with us. And in the days since then, I understand from my colleagues who are still in Iraq that this has only intensified. There was an assassination of one of the top health authorities recently, one of the top Iraqi health authorities. Hospitals are coming under attack, and there is a wariness, an increasing wariness of doctors and health authorities to work openly with non-governmental organizations and foreigners.
Do you think that independent of a Western organization like International Medical Corps that these facilities would be coming under attack? Is it their association with Westerners that are generating these attacks?
Well, that's a very good question, and I neglected to say that the health authority whose house was bombed, he interpreted that attack to be an attack on him because he was cooperating so openly with particularly the American military doctors. But I did have a look at the letter that the bombers left at his house. And by the way, he and his family were okay. They survived the attack. But there was a threatening letter left. And it didn't particularly say anything about Americans or him working with Americans. It simply warned him to leave his job. So then that brings up a question. Who is it that is behind these attacks? Is it a group that's anti-American, anti-Western? Or could it be the Baathists, who were removed from power in the aftermath of the war? This health director, as I mentioned, had been elected by his peers, but certainly somebody was out of a job. So that's a possibility as well.
Were Iraqi civilians reluctant to seek treatment at clinics and hospitals that, you know, were associated with international relief efforts?
No, in fact, it was quite the opposite. One of the guiding principles that guided our work in Iraq was that we didn't want to set up a parallel system. We didn't go in and set up a hospital, a field hospital or a clinic, because we found many functioning hospitals, many well-trained Iraqi doctors. However, still, every morning that I woke up and left the house, there would be a line of mothers holding their babies or children who they wanted myself and other physicians and nurses with my organization to examine and to treat. And so I think that it's very common in many places that aid organizations work. We're seen as Western. We're seen as that we may be bringing in something better than what the people had before. And again, this also may have been a result, in this case, of a certain mistrust of the health system, and which was notoriously corrupt under the time of Saddam, and possibly involved in certain crimes against humanity. So that may have been part of the reason why people sought us out for care.
Sherry Fink, your book, War Hospital, focuses on a hospital in this Bosnian city which was isolated. Why don't you give us a reading which describes conditions in that hospital?
Sure. This reading has to do with the time when aid workers finally reached Srebrenica Hospital, which was after a year of the hospital being completely isolated and just run by a small handful of local doctors who had found themselves stuck in a siege situation, had no experience in performing surgery, and really no tools to do it. So, and in this incident, which occurred just after the aid workers arrived, there was a shelling of a schoolyard at a time when people started to feel safe because some international aid workers had come in and some international forces. And dozens and dozens of civilians were, and children in particular, who had been playing in the schoolyard, were injured and killed. There is no water, no light. The doctors have to climb over patients, sometimes stepping on them, to reach other patients, shining flashlights in a useless effort to triage people whose wounds are buried under layers of thick winter clothes. The already beaten-down hospital staff cannot bear it. In the corridor, outside of the operating theater, people wait, arms out, begging for operations. There was also a lot of pressure from the family members, including people with weapons, one of the MSF doctors will remember. We were never threatened, but it's always a bit impressive if you see people with guns insisting that their family members will have to be treated first. So that also influenced a bit the selection for surgery. The selection or triage system, if not well implemented at first, is at least clear in the mind of the Doctors Without Borders surgeon, Pete Willems. He divides the injured into three categories. They shall wait, they shall die, or we shall give salvation. That second category is the most excruciating. Those injured in the head or chest will die without immediate intervention, but for each one, surgery would require 3 to 5 hours in the operating room. That is too much precious time. In another place, at another time, they might have been saved.
Now tell us, why was the situation in Srebrenica and at this hospital so desperate?
The situation at Srebrenica Hospital was desperate for a variety of reasons. One was the fact that this little town in eastern Bosnia had become surrounded by Serb forces. The Bosnian War took place in 1992. It began, and very quickly, I think it was about 75% of the territory of Bosnia was held by Serb forces, who then expelled most of the non-Serb population. And this was particularly true in eastern Bosnia, which, if you look on a map, borders Serbia. But one particular area, this area, Srebrenica, had a number of very tough fighters, let's say, who were able to organize a response, mostly at first with hunting rifles and actions like ambushes of the Serbian forces. And so they were able to hold on to a territory that was shrinking ever so slowly or quickly at various times the first year of the war. But all of the non-Serb population of eastern Bosnia began pouring into this region. So an area that had originally had a population of about 5,000 had ultimately a population of more than 50,000. And as I mentioned before, these 50,000 people who were being shelled and bombed in some cases, who were going out to fight, they were being, behind them stood only a handful of local doctors, and not one of them was a surgeon. There weren't, the hospital, Srebrenica Hospital, before the war had been a maternity hospital. There was really no surgery that had ever gone on there. The only thing the doctors found at the very start of the war was a little bit of local anesthesia found in the dental clinic. So not only did the doctors there lack any kind of experience with war medicine, let alone surgery, but they didn't have the tools to do their job. Add to that, no electricity, no running water, and very frequent military actions and attacks. And you just had a very, very desperate situation. One of the most difficult situations, I think, that any doctor or nurse could imagine being put in.
My guest is Dr. Sherry Fink. She's the author of War Hospital, A True Story of Surgery and Survival. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is physician Sherry Fink. She's participated in several international relief and human rights efforts and is the author of War Hospital, a book about medical personnel isolated in the town of Srebrenica in the Bosnian Civil War. Physicians in Srebrenica were faced with the barest of circumstances, often having to operate without anesthesia, for example. Concretely, how do you do that?
Oh, boy. Well, it's not pretty. You just do what you have to do, and the doctors would constantly talk their patients through the procedure, and they would just say, hold on, hold on. And the patients were, from what I've heard, just incredibly stoic. And I think just knowing that the procedure that they were undergoing, although it would be tremendously painful in the short term, might help save their lives, got them through it. But it was horrible. And I think if more people know about how horrible the situation was, hopefully, maybe more of us will be motivated to make sure that something like this doesn't happen in the future.
A lot of the kinds of surgery that you would need on a battlefield is pretty specialized. I mean, heart surgery or neurosurgery. And as you mentioned, these medical personnel didn't have that kind of training. There was a particular story where Dr. Ilyaz was confronted. I don't know if you recall this, where somebody, I guess he had a kind of a brain hemorrhage. And he'd literally never done neurosurgery. Do you recall this particular anecdote?
Yes, yes.
Tell us that story. Yeah.
This is an amazing story. So Dr. Ilyaz, who was a sort of a country bumpkin, let's say, a first guy in his family to go to college, really the first person from this rural part of eastern Bosnia to go to medical school and become a doctor, had never had any ambitions to become a surgeon, was in some ways kind of thrust into the position of becoming the surgeon for this population. And over the years, he did receive some assistance from Doctors Without Borders once they were able to get into Srebrenica. But at one point, he had gone finally for his first vacation of during the war. He was given a few days off to travel to another village and just take a few days off. And this was after more than 2 years of practicing under these difficult conditions. But as fate would have it, when he got to this village, there was a helicopter that had been ferrying in supplies, a Bosnian helicopter that was furtively doing this, and it was shot down. And there were quite a number of survivors of this helicopter crash, but they had terrible injuries. And one of the young men who was injured had a brain injury. It was clear to Ilyas when he examined the man that he was going to die shortly. But the man's father came and just pleaded with Dr. Ilyas. He said, just do whatever you can. Try something, anything. Just relieve us of this feeling that we didn't do something. And so against his better judgment, against the medical tenet, first do no harm, Ilyas took him to the operating room and tried to remember back from medical school what it was that he should do. And he was able to relieve the pressure by opening the skull, making a little opening and sewing up a blood vessel that had been the cause of this man's bleeding in his brain. And he saved the guy's life. And I really love this story because a few months later, Srebrenica fell. The town was overtaken by Serbian forces, and the entire population either took to the woods in a desperate bid to reach another Bosnian government-held territory or turned themselves over to some UN soldiers who were nearby and hoped for protection. And as many people know, this ended up being the biggest massacre in European soil in 50 years. Up to 8,000, mostly men and boys, were killed. But this young man, who Ilyas saved just a few months earlier, is credited with saving about 20 lives. During that journey through the woods, he went back. He made it to safety and went back and led another group of 20 men and boys to safety. So that one life that Dr. Ilyas saved ended up saving 21 lives.
One of the dilemmas that you confront in this situation is whether to treat soldiers, because if you treat soldiers, then you can be seen by the other side as assisting, you know, to in restoring the combat capability of one side. How do international relief workers deal with that issue?
I think that international aid workers tend to want to keep away from treating soldiers. And in some cases, that's fine because the soldiers may have their own doctors treating them. But in a case where there is nobody else to treat a soldier, an injured soldier, then a doctor has an ethical duty to provide that care. And that just goes to the concept of the neutrality of medical practice in war. That's why people aren't supposed to shoot at doctors in hospitals, because they treat all patients equally. And any injured soldier becomes protected under international law.
You write in the book that medicine was a weapon in this war. What did you mean by that?
Medicine, just like troops and munitions and guns, is one of, you could even say, the fuels that keep the engine of war running. It's a fact. When soldiers have doctors behind them, they can fight more effectively. They know that they'll have the peace of mind to know that they'll be treated. And so when a particular side has more doctors and better medical facilities and better amount of supplies, they can go out and fight more effectively. So one of the negative consequences of aid might be that it enables a military to fight better. And not, it doesn't just help civilians, which is what it's usually intended to do, but it might strengthen a military. It might actually be stolen by a military. In certain cases in the book, there were times where medical aid that was brought in by Doctors Without Borders was taken out of hospitals and used in the military. And a couple of times after Srebrenica finally got some aid, there were the Serb side argued that they went out and fought more after that. So there's that. There's also the negative consequence of aid when it was used, as many aid workers in Bosnia felt, as a cover for inaction among the international community, a way of saying that we're doing something without really addressing what was keeping this war going. The war lasted for more than 3 years. So does that mean, though, that aid should not be delivered, that we should give up the enterprise of aid? Well, no, I don't think so. However, I do think that aid workers need to look very closely at what those negative consequences might be, or what the unintended consequences might be, and plan for them. And certainly in some cases, not deliver aid. And these are some of the most excruciating decisions that aid workers have to make.
Well, Sherry Fink, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Sherry Fink, she just returned from a medical aid mission to Iraq. Her new book about doctors treating patients during the war in Bosnia is called War Hospital. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of A Place of Hiding, a novel of mystery set on the island of Guernsey by Elizabeth George, author of the Inspector Lindley Mysteries. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, as the U.S. Open approaches, athletic trainer Doug Spreen tells us about treating the world's top tennis players at high-stakes matches. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel Breaking Her Fall, and Jeff Nunberg considers the battle between Fox News and Al Franken over the use of the term fair and balanced. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. Novelist Stephen Goodman is a professor of creative writing at George Mason University and past president of the Penn Faulkner Foundation. He's also adept, says book critic Maureen Corrigan, at churning out a good old-fashioned page-turner. Here's her review of Godwin's latest novel, Breaking Her Fall.
The enchanted phrase, summer reading, for me means lots of mysteries, maybe a biography, and at least one melodramatic novel whose plot revolves around a decent man or woman who stumbles into moral quicksand. The harder that character squirms, the more he or she gets sucked in. Even as we readers sweat along with the hapless hero or heroine, we're also reassured by the knowledge of how these stories usually end. That is, at the 11th hour, fate will toss our victim a rope, and he or she will emerge, muddied but unbowed, on the firm ground of deliverance. The moral melodrama of last summer was Ann Packer's engrossing novel, The Dive from Clawson's Pier, which has just come out in paperback. This summer's exquisitely rendered migraine is Stephen Goodwin's novel, Breaking Her Fall. It's an intelligent story full of vivid characters and narrative digressions and a great neo-Dickensian ending that just about falls into the safety zone of credibility. Here's the originating mess. On a summer evening back in 1998, an amiable divorced dad named Tucker Jones drops his 14-year-old daughter Catherine, nicknamed Cat, off at a busy street in Washington, D.C. She's going to a movie with her best girlfriend. The novel is narrated by Tucker in retrospect, and at this point in the story, he ironically recalls that there wasn't a speck of makeup on Kat's face, but she'd painted her toenails, and I thought that if this was how she was going to fix herself up, her feet, not her face, she was still a girl, still a long way from trouble. But the two girls run into friends, and one of the boys in the group invites everybody back to his house. His parents are away, he has a pool, and access to the liquor cabinet. A few hours later, Tucker gets a phone call, not as he expects from Kat checking in, but from another father whose daughter has fled the wild party. This guy tells Tucker that Kat is at the party, drunk, and that when last seen, she was about to perform oral sex on a parade of boys. Frantic, Tucker drives off to the house and finds only a few boys talking around a patio table. He picks up a stray garden spade as he approaches them. Looking back, he says he doesn't know why he did that. Maybe it was because he's a professional landscaper and compulsive about tools lying around. Or maybe he thought he'd need protection. Jed Vandenberg, the arrogant boy who lives in the house, won't tell him where Kat is. Tucker gets into a shoving match with Jed. Jed falls, strikes his head against an iron table edge, and ultimately loses an eye. Assault charges and a long period of estrangement from Kat, the beloved daughter Tucker was trying to rescue, follow. Breaking Her Fall is a rich story that shoots off in multiple directions. It tackles, among other subjects, Kat's confusion about her own sexuality, the class politics of the landscaping business, the sweetly pathetic courage of middle-aged garage bands, the elusive lure of faith, and the social gradations of Washington geography. Goodwin is especially adept at conjuring up the halting, hurtful quality of a certain type of conversation between middle-class parents and their adolescent children. He also addresses the catch-22 terrors of contemporary enlightened fatherhood. Early in the story, Tucker confesses, "I suppose we all regarded ourselves as too highly evolved to admit how frightening it was to watch our daughters come of age, to develop hips and breasts and turn into young women at a time when the juggernaut of popular culture seemed to bear down on them with the relentless message that they could fulfill themselves as dopey sex kittens." Because there's even the specter of a trial here, Breaking Her Fall evokes light comparisons to Kill a Mockingbird, that granddaddy of all good man in a sticky situation tales. But Tucker is a New Age shadow of Atticus Finch, soft on certitude and guided less by the Bible than by Eric Clapton.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Breaking Her Fall by Stephen Goodwin. Coming up, treating the injuries of the world's top tennis players during competition, we meet athletic trainer Doug Spreen. This is Fresh Air. The U.S. Open tennis tournaments begin next week at Forest Hills in New York, And while fans will focus on the competition, my guest Doug Spreen will be worrying about blisters, cramps, and other injuries of the players who launch 120-mile-an-hour serves and run full speed for 3 hours in the August heat and humidity. The exertion alone has on occasion left well-conditioned athletes delirious with heat exhaustion. Spreen is an athletic trainer for the ATP, the Professional Tennis Tour. For 9 years, he's been on the court in high-stakes matches, responsible for treating the aches and pains of the world's best male tennis players, often with a 3-minute clock ticking. Doug Spreen was an assistant trainer for the Cincinnati Reds before joining the Pro Tennis Tour. He was also the head trainer for tennis players at the Olympics, both in 1996 and 2000. Now, players will be playing the U.S. Open in a hot part of the year, and heat and humidity can certainly take a toll on players. And I wonder if the death of Corey Stringer, the Minnesota Vikings player who died at training camp 2 years ago, has affected the thinking on the part of tennis pros and trainers about the dangers of that.
Well, it has always been a concern for us because for a decent part of the year, we kind of chase the sun and we chase the heat ourselves. And it's tough. I mean, it's not uncommon for our guys to be playing in 90 degree plus weather when it's humid, and court temperatures can reach 130, 140 on the hard courts. And, you know, these guys can be out there for 3 or 4 hours. So heat illness and you know, heat exhaustion are definitely part of our game. The fortunate thing we have in tennis is our guys are able to wear shorts and short sleeve shirts, and they don't have to pile all that equipment on them. We don't really deal so much with the core temperatures. We just deal with a lot of dehydration. It's amazing how much fluid somebody can lose in 2-3 hours on a tennis court.
How much can they lose?
We've actually had guys tested. Guys who have had problems with cramping and with the heat in the past, we've actually sent them to some labs and had them tested. And it is not uncommon under exercise conditions for these guys to test at losing 2.5, 3. We even had an athlete test out at losing over 4 liters of fluid an hour. And that's a tremendous amount of fluid. And it really physiologically is only possible to put about 2 liters at the most back into your system an hour. And so 2-3 hours on a tennis court, you can quickly become several liters behind in your fluid.
So what do you do?
Well, if it's during a match, it's a matter of trying to manage the situation as best you can. Get as much fluid as you can in on changeovers, trying to keep yourself cool. And then after a match, it's really important for a player to work on hydration almost immediately after a match. One of the things we find is that both with hydration and with nutrition, with food, is that the body uses a greater percentage of what you put in it in the first 2 hours after activity, after exercise. And so one of the things that you really have to avoid in hot weather is the cumulative effects. And this is something that may have happened with Corey Stringer, may happen with other people. They're fine for a day or two exercising in the heat, but what they do is they don't replace the fluids that they've lost on a day-to-day basis. And so after one day, they're a half a liter behind. Another day, they're 2 liters behind. And all of a sudden, the third day of exercise, now they're putting themselves in danger. So we really stress with our players that immediately when they get off court, they've really got to focus on drinking and eating something and trying to get themselves prepared for the next match. If that's a day or two later, the preparation for that match starts as soon as they get off the court.
Do tennis players use steroids or other performance-enhancing drugs?
I would think that the usage is very, very minimal, if any. We have an extremely good drug testing program in the ATP. These guys are tested. I was just talking to somebody who told me the other day they've been tested 14 times so far this year. And I don't get the sense. I've been in the game now for 9 years, and we've had so few guys test positive that really is not a big issue in our sport. Tennis is a sport that really goes to the issue of repetitive activity. And if you watch guys hit forehands and backhands, it's not about muscling a ball. It's not about all the power being delivered on one shot. And the motion in tennis, the serve, forehand, backhand, it's a fluid motion. And you will see an enormous amount of range of motion. You take a guy like an Andy Roddick, And before he hits a serve, the how far back his shoulder gets, his hand gets in cocking to hit that serve, is amazing. And that's really, not only is he strong, but he also develops it because he's got such great range of motion that he can develop that power over a pretty good distance. And so for an athlete, especially in tennis where flexibility is so important, to become muscle bound is really counterproductive.
You said that tennis is a real endurance sport. Is that why tennis players are younger than other athletes, why they don't last into their late 20s and 30s?
Andre Agassi right now seems to be the guy that is going against that trend. He's 33. He's held himself together. He's been relatively injury-free, and the guy's still, you know, ranked in the top three or four in the world right now. Won the Australian Open, and at the U.S. Open, he'll be one of the favorites. But it seems like when our guys reach the age of 30, that seems to be a time when they seem to be retiring. Tennis is a young person's sport, and it's a sport that the guys are so close in their competition right now. There's so little that separates anybody in the top 100 that just the fact of getting to a certain age and losing half a step or losing a little bit of pop on that serve or that forehand can make a huge difference. There's not many matches that we have anymore that are blowouts. And so just losing 1 or 2% off your game makes a huge difference. And so you don't see many guys reach their mid-30s and they're still out here playing.
Now, in other pro sports, athletes have their own trainers and coaches right there. Tennis is different, right?
Yeah, tennis is different. You know, it's different working in an individual sport because I'm responsible for all the guys. And so it's I'm in a unique position as an athletic trainer that when I send two guys on court, I've maybe prepared both those guys. Often, two guys that are going out on court before a match are sitting on two treatment tables right next to each other, getting ready to go out on court, and I have to be ready to help both guys.
Why doesn't tennis permit each player to bring their own trainer and medical staff onto the court?
Well, they do permit them to bring their own trainer, their own massage therapist, their own conditioning coach, their own coaches to a tournament, credentialed. They can work with those people before and after matches. But one of the reasons that they don't allow it during matches is because there are rules, first of all, of how we can, what we can treat and for how long we can treat people. And the other thing is that it's a duration sport. It's a sport that physical condition is definitely a part of it. And so it's very important to have somebody neutral to make that decision when it's appropriate for somebody to receive some medical care, to receive some medical treatment, to in essence, cause a short break in the match. And we want to have as little break as we can in the match. One of the things that I always think about when I go on court is if I go on court to treat a player, I got to realize that the other player on the other side of the net is also being affected by the potential delay, the potential just sometimes mentally it can wear on you. Is the guy I'm playing really hurt or not hurt? Is he playing games with me? And I got to remember that it affects the other guy on the other side of the court. And so I've got to try and treat those guys fairly. And that's a part of my job. And that's part of letting the guys tennis do the talking on the court.
What are the rules that govern an injury timeout if a player has a cramp or a problem?
Well, a player can receive a 3-minute, what we call a medical timeout on court for an injury. When I get called on the court, I have evaluation time. I get a chance to evaluate the problem or the injury with a player. And that evaluation time is unlimited, meaning if we felt it was serious enough that a player had a heart condition or just something that was potentially dangerous, we can call for a doctor to come on court. That happens less than 0.1% of the time. Usually we try and do our evaluation very quickly, 30 seconds. A lot of times we can. A guy says, hey, I have a blister on my foot. That takes about 2 seconds to evaluate the fact that his foot's bleeding. But we try and do an evaluation for whatever the problem is as quickly as we can. Get it done in 30 seconds. And then once I start doing anything for the player, if it's taping, if it's massaging, if it's doing some exercises or some stretching, I have a total of 3 minutes to do whatever I can with the player to help him. And after that, we're then allowed to treat the player for two changeovers. So the 90 seconds that they have between every second game, we can then go back on court sometime during the match and treat them for 90 seconds.
Now, there was a controversy at the U.S. Open 2 years ago at a match between Justin Gimelstob and Mikhail Tabara. After the match, Tabara thought that Gimelstob had been faking an injury during the match in order to gain time. Because he wasn't in as good a condition. And in fact, he said that he actually spit at him after the match. And this came up in the post-game press conference with Gimelstob. Do you recall being in that one? Do you recall the injury timeouts?
You know, I recall the spitting or the alleged spitting. I think that was more of a case. You get that sometimes after matches. Guys aren't happy with the fact that a guy called for the trainer and had an injury. And sometimes guys just aren't happy with the way a guy carries himself on the court. But I do remember that situation. And Justin Gimelstob is a guy who's had problems with the heat and heat exhaustion and cramping in the past, probably as much as anybody. And one of the things that once I explain it to players is that Justin's problem and his issues is not the fact that he doesn't work hard enough, and it's not the fact that he's not in good condition. Justin is one of those guys that has an enormous sweat rate. This guy literally can cause a pool of sweat around him. He is losing liters and liters and liters of fluid during each match. And so he literally is a guy that his physiologic makeup causes him to lose more fluids than he can possibly put into his system. And so he does have problems with cramping. And one of the things that's difficult for like a Mikhail Tabara in that situation and for tennis players is sometimes there's guys out there that no matter what, they never have cramped. And so they don't understand how other guys can have cramping.
Gimelstob said in his post-match press conference that if any of the reporters doubted him, they could talk to Doug Spreen. Did anybody come to you and ask you what happened?
Yeah, a couple reporters did come and talk to me, and in that case, I was able to say with 100% conviction that Justin was suffering from muscle cramps and that he had played by the rules.
You mentioned earlier that before matches, players are often side by side on training tables or in locker rooms. Do they ever pick up information about little problems, injuries, or vulnerabilities, and then try to exploit them in the match?
That only makes sense that they do that. I think one of the things is there aren't that many secrets. If a guy's getting his shoulder treated two or three times a day, people can pretty much pick up on that he's at least got some soreness in that shoulder. There are a lot of times, though, when guys go on court and their opponent knows nothing of what's going on. And when it is appropriate, we will make sure that a player has his privacy, that we communicate with that player in private, even find a way to treat that guy privately so that whatever he's got going can be a secret. But in a game where the guys live and exist so closely together, and there aren't many secrets. And also, players can pick up on another guy's weakness and another guy's problem pretty quickly out on court. They know each other so well. They've played against each other. They've probably scouted the other player. And they can tell when all of a sudden, hey, this guy's not serving like he normally does. They'll be able to pick up on that something may be amiss with their opponent.
Doug Spreen, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Doug Spreen is athletic trainer for the Professional Tennis Tour. Next week, he'll be at Forest Hills in New York for the U.S. Open. Coming up, Jeff Nunberg on the Fox News lawsuit against Al Franken. This is Fresh Air. The Fox News lawsuit against Al Franken for using Fox's trademark slogan, Fair and Balanced, in the title of his new book, has a lot of people wondering how someone can own a common phrase. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has testified in a number of trademark cases and weighs in here.
A lot of people were surprised to realize that Fox News could own the slogan Fair and Balanced in the first place, much less that they could get after Al Franken for using the phrase in the title of his new book, Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, A Fair and Balanced Look at the Right. But it's no different from Nike trademarking Just Do It. Nike can stop me from using that as a slogan for my products, but not from using the phrase when I'm telling my daughter to clean up her room. That will certainly be part of Franken's defense, that he's just using the phrase in a descriptive way, not trying to delude people into thinking he's associated with a network. In fact, if there was ever any possibility of confusion here, it's been pretty much eliminated by all the coverage of the lawsuit, which has sent Franken's book to the top of the Amazon.com bestseller list. And in any event, the law gives a lot of latitude for fair use, particularly in the case of satire. But if Franken wants to make mischief for Fox, some lawyers have suggested that he could make a counterclaim and ask the court to cancel Fox's trademark on the grounds that it's what's called deceptively misdescriptive. That is, it induces people to buy the product by misrepresenting its properties. That could mean that the court would have to decide whether the slogan Fair and Balanced is an accurate description of Fox News, with the prospect of Bill O'Reilly and Neil Cavuto having to take the stand to defend their balance in the face of hostile questioning. Now that's a trial that would drop Kobe Bryant to the bottom of the hour. But it's hard to believe any judge would want to take that question on. And actually, Fox's best defense against the charge of deception would be to argue that the slogan Fair and Balanced is just vague puffery that nobody's likely to take as a verifiable claim. That's the principle that allows car rental companies to get away with registering trademarks like Thrifty and Budget without having to demonstrate that their rates are really cheaper than others. Of course, that would put Fox in the awkward position of having to argue that their slogan is merely transparent hype. But it would be a pretty solid defense. There may be lots of consumers who would assume that a car seat cover called Lovey Lamb was made of real lambskin. But it's hard to believe that the average television viewer is going to assume that a network's news offerings are fair and balanced just because the network says they are. That would be like trusting a used car dealer because he calls himself Honest Angus. In fact, that's what made the Fair and Balanced slogan so striking when Fox came up with it 7 years ago. When people make a point of advertising their credibility or reliability, it's usually because there's a widespread assumption that the field is full of untrustworthy characters, like the used car business. You don't often see banks depicting themselves as honest. That would raise all the wrong questions. And the fact that Schwab is out there touting the integrity of their stock recommendations suggests what's happened to the reputation of brokerage firms over the past few years. And of course, Fox's Fair and Balanced line was an obvious reference to all the mentions of media bias that we've been seeing in the press over the past 15 years, more than 95% of them referring to liberal or left-wing bias. In fact, if you looked only at how disproportionately the press talks about liberal bias, you'd have a hard time understanding how anybody could imagine that it has one. In recent decades, in fact, both balanced and bias have become partisan words. Anybody who advertises himself as balanced or unbiased nowadays is a pretty good bet to have a right-wing point of view. The Fair and Balanced slogan drives liberals crazy, of course, given that Fox News doesn't exactly hide its point of view under a bushel. But then, the point of the slogan isn't to sell liberals on the network's even-handedness. It's about the pleasure that conservatives take in knowing how much the slogan annoys the other side. It's like Ozzy Osbourne biting off a bat's head on stage. Kids get a kick out of imagining how their parents will react. What's significant is that Fox didn't use the word objective in its slogan. That word implies a neutral, dispassionate presentation, what the philosopher Thomas Nagel described as the view from nowhere. It's true that objectivity has always been a hotly debated value. As the historian Michael Schudson said, it's a notion that seems to disintegrate as soon as it's formulated. But until now, most broadcast journalists have taken objectivity as an ideal, even if it's ultimately an unattainable one. Of course, Fox's problem with objectivity is only that it sounds like a turnoff. It's more lively to let the partisans square off on camera and let the viewers decide. And if the network itself has an obvious point of view, that's just a question of balancing the surreptitious bias behind all the ostensible objectivity on the other channels. Still, it's a sign of the times that Fox has become the champion of epistemological relativism. After all, who's to say they're not balanced? As that eminent postmodernist Rupert Murdoch might put it, you pays your money and you takes your choice.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University's Center for the Study of Language and Information and author of The Way We Talk Now. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Monique Nazareth, and Megan Howell, with Patty Lesming, Jessica Chu, and Ian Chillog. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Anne Marie Baldonado directed today's show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Pantheon Books, a division of Random House Incorporated, publishers of Reunion, the new novel by Alan Lightman, author of Einstein's Dreams and The Diagnosis. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about spend control with Eric Desenhall, a Washington, D.C.-based writer and damage control consultant. He tells us when he advises clients to apologize, when he attacks their accusers, and when he simply won't take the case. Desenhall worked for the Reagan administration, and he's also a novelist. His latest book is called Jackie Disaster. Join us for the next Fresh Air.